This week on The Score, what did Beto O'Rourke say when he came to Charlottesville? Is there a future for redistricting reform in Virginia? Will Congress take back power from the president? How do politicians celebrate Labor Day in Buena Vista? Do Hollywood movie makers understand the Civil War? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Earlier this week, as the nation celebrated the end of summer with Labor Day picnics, fun runs, and baseball games, political leaders and candidates came to the small city of Buena Vista for the traditional launch of the Virginia campaign season. There are no statewide or federal candidates on the ballot this year, but I spoke with 6th District Congressman Ben Klein, State Senator Cree Deeds, and Delegate Ronnie Campbell, plus an independent candidate running for the House of Delegates. After the annual parade, I talked to State Senator Cree Deeds of the 25th District. He has represented the district since 2001. I asked him about legislative priorities in the coming year, and specifically about redistricting reform. From Glenmorey Park in Buena Vista, Virginia, here is Cree Deeds. Senator Cree Deeds, thank you for joining us again on The Score from Bering Drift. You're running for re-election?
I am.
What's at stake in this year's election?
Everything's at stake. This is the most critical election of my lifetime. You know, we stand right now a good chance of taking majorities in both the House and the Senate, and if we do that, we will have the opportunity to build on Medicaid expansion, to build, I think, the most important and most significant public mental health care system in the country, to the most effective system. We have the opportunity to invest more in higher education and also in K-12. We invest in higher education, we keep tuition down. We invest in K-12, we give people the opportunity to succeed at the next level of education or in the workforce. We have the opportunity to invest in infrastructure, to put more money in rural broadband. I think that everything's at stake right now.
Today's Labor Day. We're here in Buena Vista. What can the General Assembly or the Virginia government in general do on behalf of working people in Virginia?
Well, what we do most importantly on behalf of working people is create opportunities for people to succeed. And we do that by investing in education, by investing in infrastructure. We can also make sure that there's a level playing field, that people have a chance to compete fairly all across the Commonwealth. We do that for working people, but for everybody in general. You know, I don't think we have to separate people out. We have to work for all Virginians, and we have to treat people fairly. You know, I think we can do that.
What can the government do to make it easier for people to start businesses?
What can the government do to incent people to start businesses? Well, you know, in general, we have to make sure that we have our tax and regulatory structures are both favorable for people who want to take chances and start businesses. But again, it's about investment in critical things like infrastructure and education. The state's not, I don't think that the state is really the business starter. The state just has to create a level playing field and allow people to compete.
I want to return to a topic we've discussed many times in the past, which is redistricting reform. You were in the 25th District, 25th Senate District. Is it possible to drive across the 25th District without going into another district?
Well, not really. I mean, the closest is to travel up to Vesuvius and go over the mountain to Montebello. But even there, you go through Augusta County a little bit. The 25th district, I don't think will look this way after the next redistricting.
Well, my next question is, what kind of criteria will be set to redistrict in 2021?
Well, I'm hopeful that if we get a redistricting amendment passed that takes redistricting to some extent outside of the General Assembly, we can pass criteria that resembles what exists in Iowa right now, to make sure that incumbents aren't protected and that it makes sure that neither party is given an advantage. You know, but I can wish in one hand and that's not necessarily going to happen. The amendment that passed the General Assembly is not the one that I would have written. It's not what I proposed, but it's better than what we have right now.
What do you see the prospects of that being? Does that depend on the outcome of the election this year?
I just don't know. I think before the election, everybody talks about redistricting reform. You know, I've got a pretty clear record of introducing legislation in this regard for years, and so I know where I stand. I'm not sure where others stand. I think we were able to build bipartisan consensus around the legislation, the constitutional amendment that passed this last session. Will that consensus remain firm regardless of the party that's in charge? I don't know. I hope so.
Just to wind up, as you're campaigning for re-election this year, what are you hearing from your constituents? What really concerns them, both on the state and the national level?
Well, on the national level, I really that would take up a long time. the state level, people want to make sure that localities are treated fairly when it comes to funding things like education and transportation. They want to make sure that there are opportunities in every part of Virginia. And this part, rural parts of Virginia, you know, a lot of people feel left out. We didn't recover during the recovery of the 90s, you know, from the recession that occurred before then. We never recovered. And so people want opportunity in this part of Virginia and the rural parts of the state.
Well, Senator Dietz, thank you for your time
today.
I appreciate it. Have an enjoyable Labor Day.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
For a long time, Ben Klein spoke every year at the Buena Vista Labor Fest as the delegate from the 24th House of Delegates District. Last year, he was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives from the 6th Congressional District. I asked him to compare the Virginia General Assembly to Congress, and then we talked about some policy issues, like the Trump administration's disastrous trade policy and its harmful effects on farmers. Here's Congressman Ben Klein.
Congressman Ben Klein, last time I saw you here at Buena Vista, you were a member of the Virginia House of Delegates. Now you're a member of the U.S. House of Representatives.
Those were the days.
How does it compare? Can you compare and contrast the way things operate in Washington and in Richmond?
I have a new appreciation for the great work they do in Richmond after going from a functional legislature to a dysfunctional legislature. It is hard going from the majority to the minority, but that's not the hardest part. The hardest part is not being able to solve the problems of the people because of all of the dysfunction.
And how does it compare on Capitol Hill today to when you were a staffer about 20 years ago?
There were more people willing to cross lines to get things done. It's challenging to find those people. We were able to do that this year. We got several bills enacted. But you know, on some of the bigger picture issues, that's what it's going to take. People willing to accept 98% of what they're trying to get instead of holding out for the 100%.
A number of your colleagues, like Will Hurd and Sean Duffy, have announced that they're retiring from Congress. Do you think that it stands for something? Does it represent the dysfunction you're talking about?
Absolutely. The frustration of having to be away from your family, away from your community, spending too much of your time worrying about fundraising and the next political hit as opposed to trying to actually work on legislation.
Speaking of legislation, yesterday the president imposed taxes in the billions of dollars on American families. That's likely to double in December. What can we do to offer relief to these high tax increases that the administration is imposing?
The president is tackling the imbalance in our trade with China, and that is something that has been needed for many, many years. The last administration ignored it. It got worse. I commend this president for tackling it. Tariffs, I'm generally not a fan of, so I view them as a temporary measure. If we can get this trade deal in place and the tariffs can come off, all the better. That's what he's trying to do with Mexico and Canada right now. It's what he's done with Japan and South Korea, and I think he will be able to do it with China here soon.
The Constitution gives the power of taxation to the Congress. Do you think Congress has delegated too much taxation authority to the executive branch?
Well, I think that tariffs generally have an impact that can be similar to taxes, but they're not the same thing. So I would argue
tariffs are taxes.
Well, I would argue that they're slightly different, and that Congress has, while they have delegated too much authority to the administration over the years, tariff authority, I think different trade agreements, we should look at reining in a lot of that authority. Congress needs to regain control of the purse in general, in addition to foreign affairs, in addition to regulatory affairs. So, yes, I would absolutely support that.
The retaliation against these tariffs and trade policy has caused a lot of pain, especially among farmers. Bankruptcies are a record level. Farmers are not able to sell their products. This is a rural district that you represent. What are you doing to address the problems of the farming community?
We need to get the new NAFTA passed so that Canada will grant access to a lot of our agriculture goods. That's going to be a major step forward. If Nancy Pelosi will put that up for a vote, I have no doubt it will pass. And with this Chinese agreement that hopefully will come very soon, we can see a lot of these tariffs come off and free trade be the law of the land again.
You must hear from your constituents on a lot of issues. What's the thing that's hitting your mail on Capitol Hill more than anything else?
You know, right now, people just are very frustrated with the inaction of Congress. They want to see Congress do more to address economic challenges, continue to stimulate job growth, and lay the foundation for a strong economy. We need to keep doing that, and Nancy Pelosi needs to wake up and realize that a do-nothing Congress is bad for the American people.
Are there any bills that you're sponsoring right now that we should be aware of that people might want to support?
Sure. I've had four that I've either been the lead Republican co-sponsor on or the lead Republican sponsor of that have been signed into law, dealing with reforming our bankruptcy laws, helping our veterans, helping our small businesses, creating more economic development here locally. So some government reform bills are going to be out there that I would love to see passed. Those are tougher nuts to crack because the power that our leadership has, they don't want to give it up. But delegating more power to the states, sending more of the bureaucracy out to the middle America, that's the kind of reform I want to see happen.
You mentioned delegating more power to the states, and that's actually a question I had in mind for you. There's been a lot of discussion this summer on firearms regulation. Do you think that most of that should be done at the state level rather than have the federal government get involved?
Well, I think the Second Amendment is very important. That's why it was second of the 10 initially. And so preserving that right of Americans to protect themselves and their families and their communities is paramount. But when it comes to actual laws related to firearms, I do think the states have a better place, a better role to play. And Virginia has some of the strongest Second Amendment protections in place, and we need to keep it that way.
Well, my final question is, it's Labor Day here in Buena Vista. What can Congress do to address the needs of working people across the country? And practically everybody is a working person.
Get government out of the way. The more government gets out of the way to free people up to pursue their own goals and pursue their own endeavors, small businesses will succeed, liberty will rule, and we'll be better for it as a nation.
Well, Congressman Ben Klein, thank you for joining us on the Score from Bering Drift. It's good to see you again. It's good to see you in your new role.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BeringDrift.com.
Ben Klein's successor in the 24th District seat in the House of Delegates is Ronnie Campbell, who joined the General Assembly early this year after a special election. I wanted to find out from him what he has learned about the legislative process and what kind of bills he will be sponsoring if he gets reelected in November. From Buena Vista, here's Delegate Ronnie Campbell.
Delegate Campbell, what are your priorities as you're running for reelection? And this is your first general election, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I'm following up on some things that came about as being a legislator. One of them is fixing a route here in Buena Vista so permit loads can come in and out of the city with reasonable care. I'm working on trying to get Lexington a bypass route around Lexington for tractor-trailer trucks so they don't have to go downtown to go through the city because of permit loads. So basically, some small items that are tied in with my state police experience that I knew these items were out there, and I'm looking at those. And then I'm following up on this coming session. The Carpenters Union and I are looking at a couple of bills that I'm going to introduce for them. Unions can work with delegates, and the delegate can still protect Virginia's right to work law. So you have to be careful, but I have talked to them about a couple of things, and they're things that are good, and they understand where I'm coming from. So we're going to work together on some stuff this coming session, too.
What are the topics of those bills?
One of them is a wage theft bill. It involves with anybody that works for a living having his wages stolen from him by a boss that's one of the ways he makes ends meet on the job. And that is more widespread than you would think. I even saw it in the state police dealing with tractor-trailer truck and dump truck drivers and stuff. You'd check your truck and write them some tickets. The boss would fire them to keep from paying the tickets and not pay them for their wages for that week or what he owed them. And we're talking about people that make $8 to $15 an hour. And if you get cheated out of 1 or 2 weeks of pay, by the time you get a lawyer, take the boss to court, you show up in court, you're already in the negative because you're paying the lawyer. But this bill will go around that, and it will bypass that. It will allow the lawyer to be paid for by the boss if it's the judge rules in your favor. And it's just a good bill. It's just, you know, and they've got a couple others that they want me to look at a little closer. I haven't had a chance to do it. But I believe in working with everybody in the district, and that is one of my goals.
In your first session in the General Assembly, what did you learn about the legislative process that you didn't expect to be learning?
It's crazy. I was told by some of the delegates that I had a heads up on a lot of people because I came from local government. I was a supervisor here for 7 years and school board for 10 prior to that. So I basically had an understanding of the functioning of the government. It's just in Richmond, it is so overwhelming. And the first 3 weeks of the session, you get close to 3,000 bills dropped in on your desk. And trying to figure out how you're going to sort through all that and keep up with everything. And then there's other things that you need to get involved with, like there's different types of caucuses you can go to. One that I really enjoyed going to is the Sportsman's Caucus, and that was so that I could, and we sent on our Facebook, we sent stuff back from each one of those caucuses. I would take notes, and then we would write up a narrative on the subject that day and send it back to the people and the sportsmen and the citizens in the community that love animals and outdoor life and stuff like that. One of the biggest ones that I got was on ticks and the life of a tick. And you would think, who wants to think about that? But people were just amazed with the fact that the little teeny ticks are first-year ticks, and they don't carry disease. It's the second-year tick, the bigger one, that's healthy, that's matured a little bit. And, you know, and we send stuff like that back. So it's just so much work, so intense. I literally went to work at 6 in the morning, and I was either on the chamber floors or I was in my office till 7, 8 o'clock at night.
And certainly the issues that your constituents face in this district are far different from what would be of interest in Hampton Roads or Northern Virginia.
And they are, and especially Northern Virginia and that type of area. One of the things that was mentioned in here today was minimum wage. Okay? I've had about 10 business people come to me in this area, and you've got to look at the cost of living. Minimum wage is not something that you can say one size fits all. What a small business in Northbridge County can afford is different than what a small business in Fairfax or Arlington can afford. And that's the way it needs to look at it. And the people that I've talked to here have told me it's either going to put me out of business or I'm going to have to cut back on my people. So it's a jobs killer. Mm-hmm. And the cost of living and stuff in this area, you take away people that go in at that job level. It's an entry job level. And you don't really expect them to stay there. Their boss doesn't expect them to stay there. You want them to move up. But you've got to start somewhere and have some type of training. And that's pretty much that.
And another thing that affects people in your district, which is largely rural, is the trade policy that is causing devastation to farmers all across the country. What can you do to address the problems faced by farmers because of high tariffs and the taxes being imposed by the federal government on households across the country?
Well, as a state delegate, there's not a whole lot I can do. That's federal level. And, you know, we can do things locally to try to hold back on taxes and stuff like that for the farmers. One area that it's affecting a lot that people don't realize is logging. Mm-hmm. Your logging prices have dropped to next to nothing, and it's because all of our premier timber is shipped overseas for veneer products. And so the loggers are hurting, the people, the log mills, they're hurting. But there is light at the end of the tunnel, because if we can get this thing turned around and China has to start playing on a fair basis and a level basis with the country, then all these people are going to benefit. And we just got to figure out how we can go back and try to make it up to them.
Do you have a good relationship with the State Department of Agriculture and Forestry in terms of helping to serve your constituents?
I have a good relationship with the state level on that.
Any final thoughts as you go into this election campaign?
What do we got, about 64 days?
That's about it, yeah.
Yeah, I'll be glad when it's over.
Okay. Well, Delegate Ronnie Campbell, thank you for joining us on the Score from Bering Drift.
Let me add one thing to that.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I'll be glad when it's over and everybody has voted for me.
Very good. Well, thank you again for joining us. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Nice conversation.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
Before we turn back to politics during the next half hour of The Score, let's have a change of pace. Historian Gary Gallagher has taught at the University of Virginia for many years. He is an expert in the U.S. Civil War, and on Thursday, he gave an entertaining and informative lecture to the Charlottesville History Club about Hollywood's treatment of the Civil War in movies. Afterwards, I asked him to summarize his talk.
Gary Gallagher, we're talking about Hollywood and the Civil War. My first question is, why are there so many movies about the Civil War and hardly any about the American Revolution?
I think the Civil War is, for most Americans, a more dramatic and, they think, understood moment in American history. There were actually no movies on the American Revolution and almost no good ones. There aren't many good movies on the Civil War either, I don't think, but there are more. I think that there are more echoes of the Civil War now that people are aware of than of the Revolution. That's, and I emphasize that they're aware of. Obviously, the revolutionary echoes are everywhere with this now, but people are not as aware of them. And part of it has to do with the prevalence of the cluster of issues relating to race. People don't associate race with the Revolution to the degree they do with the Civil War, and I think that puts the Civil War closer to the front in many ways.
Could you list the four memory traditions that came out of the Civil War generation?
Yes, the Union, the Union cause tradition prized the salvaging of the nation as the most important thing that came out of the war. The Emancipation cause tradition said it was the destruction of slavery. The Lost cause tradition was an effort to put the best face possible on the failed Confederate experience. And the Reconciliation cause tradition brought together people on both sides who were willing to not argue about who'd been right or wrong, but just talked about what a good thing it was that the nation survived.
Why do you think Hollywood latched onto the Lost cause tradition for such a long period of time?
That is a much too complicated question for me to answer in 1 minute in a podcast. It is. There are a lot of elements to that, I think, and one is that there was a group of writers who'd done a very good job of presenting the Confederate struggle in a way that distanced it from some of the less savory parts of it. And there's the underdog element to it. They're over the overwhelming numbers and resources, but look how gallant they were. I think Robert E. Lee was a very compelling figure for many people. He was a Christian gentleman. I mean, they didn't have to make up things about him that were attractive. He was attractive to a lot of people, and he was a good loser, which meant a lot. He said, stop fighting, look forward, don't focus on the past. They won, they set the terms, we abide by the terms, we go forward. That's essentially Lee's attitude. He was unhappy, but publicly he behaved impeccably in terms of how a loser should behave in the view of those who had won.
You've seen a lot more of these Civil War movies than I have, but my own personal favorite is Shenandoah for its underlying libertarian themes. Could you just address that for a minute? What do you think about Shenandoah with James Stewart?
Well, Shenandoah is, in terms of how it deals with history, it's ludicrous because it gets almost everything wrong and pretends that just because Jimmy Stewart is kind of a libertarian and wants to do his own thing because he wants to do his own thing, that he'll be allowed to do his own thing. And, of course, he wouldn't have been. The Confederate state would have intruded in his life in innumerable ways. It was a very intrusive state. But he is a powerful, individualistic figure in that movie. And we take care of ourselves. We take care of our own. We don't ask for help from other people. But they shouldn't ask us for help in something that we don't agree with.
Well, I wish we had more time to talk about this. Your hour-long lecture today was terrific, and I hope that we have a chance to talk again sometime, because I'd really like to pursue some of these questions at another occasion.
Very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you,
Thank
too. You. Thank you.
Former Texas Congressman and current Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke came to Charlottesville last weekend. He spoke in support of retail politics, knocking on doors and speaking to voters one-on-one, and encouraged local Democrats to work on behalf of State Senate candidate Amy Laufer. O'Rourke answered a few questions from the news media, and the score was there.
So, Beto, first, what brings you to Charlottesville?
So we're back in Charlottesville because we understand that the Commonwealth, the election that takes place in 2019, this Senate district is so important, not just for Virginia, but for this country. On every issue that we care about, making sure that we have gun laws that protect our lives, health care for all, confront the challenge of climate before it is too late. These are all things that Amy is running to achieve, and I want to be here to help her and to encourage her supporters as they go door to door. Virginia is very important to us.
And in a recent Quinnipiac poll, you pulled 1%. Do you think it's important that you drop out and maybe run for Senate against Senator Cornyn? I mean, winning the Senate is pretty important as well.
I'm running for president. I want to serve this country. I want to provide the leadership that we are so badly lacking right now, guaranteeing that this country heals instead of being further divided, working with the hope that we have in one another instead of trying to make us afraid of one another, and ensuring that all of us are able to live to our full potential right now. It is something that we're missing, something that we need, and something that I'm running to provide.
Were you
Thank
you.
The
news record right here?
Yeah. So you said that Charlottesville has a lot to do with the state senate race, but how does it reflect on your presidential race?
Many of the issues that I'm hearing from people that are important for the future of this country, that are helping to define our campaign, will be decided in Charlottesville, in this Senate district, and in the Commonwealth in 2019. Literally every single one of them. I was talking to Amy before, and we were talking about education and health care, the environment, confronting climate, gun laws, immigration. All of those are on the minds of everyone here, and Amy's running that race that will in some way determine the outcome, not just for the Commonwealth, but for the country. So we want to be here to support her, to encourage those who are block walking for her right now, and to maybe share some examples of why door-to-door canvassing works, how it's been successful for us, and what it can mean not just for Virginia, but for the country.
Next, we'll go to Deepa.
Hey, Congressman. Welcome to my hometown, by the way.
Okay, cool.
So one thing that I've been hearing in line and from a lot of people I know in the area, Joe Biden launched his campaign saying that Charlottesville and the attack in 2017 was the reason that he decided to run for president. He hasn't shown up here. A lot of people aren't super happy about that. Do you have a response to that, and do you think the vice president needs to come to Charlottesville?
I can only speak for myself. This is my second visit to Charlottesville during the campaign. It's an incredibly important community, not just to Virginia, but to the country. And we've got to make sure that everyone in America knows that they count. And the only way to demonstrate that is by showing up. And we've also got to connect the dots for everybody in America about the rise in hate crimes and racism and intolerance and the violence that necessarily follows unless we confront it. And Charlottesville has an incredibly powerful story to tell, not just about the consequences of that racism and that violence and our president's actions that encourage racism and violence, but the way in which this community has sought to overcome that and to find a much better, more positive, safer future for this country. So we're here to both call attention to what is not working in this country and also to elevate those people, those political movements that are making sure that we realize our promise as Americans.
And then time for one last question to Jenna.
Are you still holding private fundraisers? Have you stopped doing that?
No, I have not stopped. In fact, we have one today. It's not a big one. It's some good friends who I went to high school with. So yes, we're having fundraisers, just not a ton of them. It's just not how I spend the majority of my time.
And I have a gun control question. Coming out for doing a buyback, on the Senate trail, you used to tell gun owners, you know, if you own an assault rifle, you own it legally, you use it safely, I'm not going to come and get it from you, don't worry. Now you're saying that you want to buy those back, that you want to get those out of the country. Can you talk a little bit? I know you've said that the reason you didn't take that stance before is just because it's politically difficult to take. But can you tell us a little bit about what exactly the threat is that you see there when it comes to people who legally own these assault rifles, have legally owned them for a long time, have them locked up in their houses? What do you see as the threat there?
We saw that threat realized in El Paso on August 3rd. Someone legally purchased an AK-47. So bizarre for that person's mother that she called the police to ask why her son needed that and what she could do. And the police had literally no option, nothing that they could do to help her. They said, ma'am, perfectly legal for him to do this. We're sorry. He took that weapon, killed 22 people, injured dozens more, committed an act of terror that has terrified and continues to terrorize a community, many of whom now feel like they have a target on their backs because of their Hispanic heritage or the assumption someone might make about their immigration status. As long as we have millions of these assault weapons, weapons of war, they are potential instruments of terror. And Americans feel terrified. Kids who worry about going into school or have already planned what they're going to do when an active shooter walks in through the door with a weapon designed to kill people on a battlefield as effectively, as efficiently, in as great a number as possible. I just read something today from Shannon Watts from Mothers Demand talking about a guidance from a school that instructs kids to grab the legs of the shooter and en masse to try to pin him down so other kids can escape. We just shouldn't have these weapons on the street. And I think we have to be honest about that, clear about what it will take, and then explain that the benefit at the end of the day is lives saved in this country that's losing more than 40,000 lives a year.
Okay. One quick one. I just want to find out, what was your reaction when your colleague Will Hurd announced he was retiring from Congress?
Grateful for Will's service and for his friendship. Anyone who dedicates this much of their life to public service in Congress, also in the CIA, should be commended. But I'm also really grateful that he will be succeeded more likely than not by a Democrat to make sure that we have the majorities necessary to achieve this very ambitious agenda that we've set out.
We are going to gaggle again later today.
Beto O'Rourke's speech and press conference in Charlottesville are on video. If you would like to see them, go to The Score's website at bearingdrift.com for a link.
The Score is produced by Bearing Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit bearingdrift.com.
Congressman O'Rourke came to Virginia to offer support to former Charlottesville school board member Amy Laufer, who is challenging State Senator Bryce Reeves in the 17th State Senate District, which includes parts of Albemarle County. I asked Laufer to explain what motivated her to run for office and to talk about her background. Here's Amy Laufer. You're running for the state senate in Virginia, 17th district, but we're here at a campaign rally that is anchored by presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke. How did he and you happen to hook up?
Well, actually, we had, this was already planned weeks in advance, probably a month in advance, with Charlottesville Democratic Committee offered to do canvassing in Albemarle County. And then the O'Rourke team reached out to us because they were going to be in the area. I think they're going to be doing a tour later today. So that's what happened. And we were already doing this.
So it's just a great coincidence.
Yeah, actually, it really was.
So what motivated you to run in the 17th district? You've lived in Charlottesville for a long time. Now you live in Albemarle?
So when I first moved here, I lived in Albemarle County in two different places. And then we moved into the city. And then we moved back into Albemarle. So it's all about 6 mile radius.
Right. It's all very close.
Yeah, exactly. I'm still shopping at the same grocery store. So, and we still have the same doctors. You know, after being on the school board for 7 years, I felt really compelled to, have a better voice in Richmond. You know, every year we see declining, support for the schools. My own son has major health issues, and it's a real concern about what will happen with health care. So I felt compelled that I wanted to add my voice to the state legislative body.
And what are the major issues you're running on?
Well, health care is number one. I can tell you at the doors, that is the number one concern of everyone, that they are afraid they're going to lose their health coverage by who knows what means, but they're afraid of that. Public education, I can tell you this district has grown substantially in the past 6 years. Every school division is facing overcrowding, and we know there is a major teacher shortage in our state, and they're all, I can tell you, I've met with every school division, and they have a shortage right now. So,
That's okay.
So those are, and I can tell you, most families are concerned about public education and funding for it. And then the other issue is broadband. We know our rural areas, 25% of the district still does not have broadband. I grew up on a dairy farm. I know how important it is to have access to markets. And those are the things I hear the most about.
Yeah, actually, the Secretary of Agriculture was here on Monday.
Yes.
And I asked him, how the agricultural sector can recover from the disastrous trade policies he demurred. But what do you think about that? How can farmers in Virginia survive in this environment in which they can't sell their products overseas?
Well, I can just tell you, as my family farm and my family's hometown, they are very concerned that they are going to lose their farms. It is a federal decision. I think as much as possible, helping farmers to diversify what they're growing, diversify how they're distributing their goods, which would include broadband access. I think that's what the state could provide. But I can tell you, I just know what it's done to my hometown.
Thank you so much.
And it's terrifying.
There was a profile of you published in the Daily Kos 3 months ago. They kind of painted you as a real radical left-winger. That doesn't seem accurate. What I know about you is you're more of a moderate. Is that a more accurate description?
I think it depends on who you talk to. I mean, I can just tell you, I grew up on a farm. I'm one of 8 children. I had to have a paying job and get good grades. I went to college. I had to fully fund my education. I did all kinds of different jobs, like packing fish in Alaska. It took me nearly 6 years to graduate because I had to fund it. Afterwards, I went into the Peace Corps. I really wanted to serve my country. And I ended up at a school, and I fell in love with education and how powerful it is to society. And I came back and I got a master's in education and became a teacher. After my second child was born, I had to stop working because he was so ill. And, I got elected to the school board, served in that capacity. I don't know if that's radical. I really just want to serve our I just really want to serve, and I want to try to make things better.
Well, fishing in Alaska, that's the most dangerous profession.
Well, actually, I was in the cannery.
Oh, okay.
Which is mainly only dangerous because you're out there for like 10 to 12 hours a day.
And where did you serve in the Peace Corps?
Jamaica.
Jamaica.
Actually, I was in the farming community of Jamaica, which was kind of ironic since I grew up on a farm. Actually, it's in the mountains there, the Blue Mountain Coffee.
And you were teaching in New York on September 11th, 2001. What was that like?
Well, I actually taught right next to the World Trade Center, and, you know, I actually saw the buildings, you know, collapse. I saw the plane go into the building. It was terrifying.
That must be seared in your memory.
It is. I can still hear what that sounded like. So,
you and I are both from Wisconsin. I grew up in Milwaukee.
What? Actually, I went to UW-Milwaukee.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think your Midwest upbringing brings to the table as a candidate here in Virginia in the Mid-Atlantic?
You know, I will say I think Midwesterners are very practical. I am very practical. I think very friendly, you know, and willing to talk and negotiate and figure out how to come to a consensus and then implement it. You know, I also think, if I can just say it, on a farm, it's like there's no shortcut. If you don't do the work, it doesn't get done, and it's up to you to make it happen. So
it's a real individualistic kind of society.
Well,
but it requires cooperation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like you can't actually harvest all of your goods without the help of others. I mean, I have 7 brothers and sisters. You know, that's what our job was, is to make that happen. So, yeah, but also I just know that if you don't do it, it's not getting done. So.
Okay, where can people find out more about your campaign?
Thank you. So you can go to Laufer for Virginia. That's L-A-U-F like Frank, E-R, F-O-R, and then Virginia. Spelled out VIRGINIA.com.
And you're on Facebook and
yes.
Twitter and everything else?
Yes.
Very good.
I don't remember my handle.
That's okay. We can find them. Okay. But Amy Laufer, thank you for talking to us on The Score from Bering Drift. I appreciate your being here today.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
The former minority leader of the House of Delegates, David Toscano, attended the rally with Beto O'Rourke and Amy Laufer. I asked him about the Democrats' prospects in November and why a major national figure like O'Rourke would inject himself in a local political race in Virginia.
What do you think brought a presidential candidate to Charlottesville today?
Well, I think he understands that Virginia is an important state in terms of the primary process and is really important in terms of the national election. I think he'd be interested in coming to a university town because he's younger. He's generating a lot of interest among young people. And I think that's why he's here.
Is Virginia really important in the primary process? It's not New Hampshire. It's not Iowa.
No, but it's one of the second level of states that come after New Hampshire, Iowa, South Carolina. And who knows what the landscape's going to look like by the time those are all done. I mean, traditionally, if you looked at it, usually one candidate wins Iowa, one wins New Hampshire, and maybe one wins South Carolina. So you could have several people still in the mix by the time you get around to Virginia.
You've been around for a long time. What do you think the prospects are for your party, the Democrats, in November here in Virginia?
I'm pretty optimistic. I think, you know, we have been picking up steam over the last several years, and as you know, in 17, we were one vote away from getting to the majority, and I think we've got wonderful candidates this time in districts that are fairer for us, with the redistricting changing the lines in certain districts. So I think we have a real shot in the House of taking it back. The Senate I'm not as familiar with, but I think they've got terrific candidates and great chance as well.
Do you think if Democrats take control of the majority in both houses that there will be a chance for redistricting reform?
I hope so. I mean, we did pass the first constitutional reading of an amendment that would go on the ballot in 2020 that would create a commission that would be quasi-nonpartisan, and that's a really good step in the right direction. I'm hoping that when the people get elected, they will retain that commitment to a nonpartisan redistricting process. But you never know. I mean, it's those in the room at the time who make the decision, and we'll see.
Yeah, there tends to be a change of attitude when parties take a new position in government. Majorities decide, we like it the way it is.
Well, I have always told my Republican friends and colleagues and my constituents that if the Democrats took control in 2020, that I would fight tooth and nail to maintain a nonpartisan redistricting. But I'm retiring at the end of December. We'll see what they do.
Well, good luck. I appreciate you being here today.
Sure. Thank you. Take care.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
Earlier in the show, we talked to Delegate Ronnie Campbell of the 24th House District. He has two opponents in this year's general election. One of them is independent candidate B. Eli Fishpaw, who is running to bring attention to climate issues. I pressed him on some other topics as well, but his main focus is climate change and what state and local government can do about it.
You are running as an independent candidate in the 24th District for the House of Delegates, is that right?
That's correct.
What motivated you to run?
I'm very motivated because in the past few election cycles, the issue of climate has not been addressed by any of the candidates. And that was a void that to me was sort of dark, and this is something I could do to address that. And then by giving a robust discussion of that issue and trying to project an image of how we could address it substantively.
And how can the state government act on this issue that you think will have an effect?
Well, I would like people to go to my website, fishpaw2019.com, and look at the ways I apply this. But the largest one, and ideally it would be better at the federal level, but it could be done at the state level, is a carbon tax. Because a carbon tax makes it more expensive to do that which is problematic, which is emissions. And the carbon tax would start out low so that people have a time to make an adjustment to this new economy, but they put in their spreadsheets about what the price is going to be in 10 years and build their business plans around that reality. Now, it would be better applied federally or even globally. And I also know, I'm not foolish enough to believe that I could get that passed in the 2020 session of the General Assembly. But the discussion about that policy is another opportunity to nurture the recognition that we need to limit our carbon emissions, carbon dioxide primarily, to that which nature can remove. And we have not had that recognition culture-wide, and I see that as the aha moment where we recognize our common threat and therefore develop a common response that can meet the challenge. The only way it can happen is with that recognition. I carry that, and whether or not I win the election or not, this forms like the Univista had the full political spectrum. I'm able to speak to the whole community. Any event that I would sponsor to address these issues would filter out a small segment. And that's why events like this are precious. They're free to the public. I mean, free to the candidate. I did not pay for this. And so, to me, that's what democracy looks like.
Are there pieces of legislation you could introduce to encourage technological innovation in Virginia that will affect the climate change?
Yes. First of all, the carbon tax is one that would affect that. But, of course, the carbon tax offers the flexibility for the private sector to adapt in ways that the government could never figure out when they're held. And so that's one of the principles I apply is a market economy with accountability for impacts. So when a business can create profit by creating an adverse impact that they're not held responsible for, that creates an incentive to do those impacts. And a business that's competing with them, then, you know, that is a tension there. So whenever we can create an accountability for impacts, we actually create a market for the businesses that service reducing that impact. And I apply it to solid waste management, recycling. Recycling's another example. The reason recycling is failing, and it is because local governments are tasked with the responsibility for managing solid waste and recycling, and yet the local governments have no influence on the materials that are coming down the pike. Who needs to be responsible for that? It should be the manufacturer, the retailer, and ultimately us as consumers. So extended producer responsibility is a term that's been coined to mean that the people who produce and profit including us as consumers, should pay for the full cost of what it takes to manage it properly. So when a manufacturer, you send a refrigerator back to the retailer, and then they can put it on the truck that's carrying the new refrigerator back to the manufacturer, and then they're holding their own product after it's been, the useful nice life has ended, they'll have new opportunities to use that material. And if they know it's coming to them, they will be able to, at the design board and in their business plan, count on it. And so all that, all those electronic things that we're throwing away, 95% of the material in those appliances is perfectly good. But because it's not cost effective to repair it, they're not meant to be repaired, they're not being held accountable, us as a consumer and businesses are not being held accountable for that cost, we dump it in, we put it in the landfill. Terrible system. We can do better than that.
I notice another of the issues that you're interested in is election reform. What kind of reforms are you advocating?
Yeah. First of all, I want to push against the trend towards creating barriers to voting. You know, the voter registration ID requirement was sort of meant, that some would say it was discouraging to people who have trouble getting to a registrar's office during business hours. You know, it would be the elderly people, the poor people. And so I would like the registrars to be proactive and be able to go to the voters if they requested it. And also I want to see high schools automatically register high school students that turn 18. We've got the records. They're all there. That's a place to be very thorough about. And then voter registration at DMV. And also I want early voting. And I want early voting without an excuse. We do. You can get an absentee ballot. You kind of got to say, oh, I'm, you know, we gone. And so it's a little integrity issue there if, you know, really you just want to vote early because it's more convenient. So by not focusing all on that single day, that we would make it more accessible to more people. So, but that's one thing. The other thing is in partisan gerrymandering. And the good news, like I said, it was SJ 306, I think it is, that was passed by bipartisan votes. So, you know, of all the division we got right now, that one was not. Although, I think it was light on the Republicans, but nonetheless, enough to get it through, because they were in the majority. And I find that very hopeful. But, as I said on stage, those things don't solve our problem if we don't have a common recognition about what is true. So, but if we can have an election, and in an event like this where I'm given an opportunity to speak without cost, then the election, the best case scenario for election is possible, which is it's about an exploration of the issues and not how much money you got.
Do you think that independent candidates like yourself can help erode the political tribalism that characterizes our society today?
Well, that's my hope. And I'm trying to put my best foot forward, and I'm trying to not make an assumption about Republicans or Democrats. You know, I have a generalization for both of these categories of people, and I know that sometimes that is wrong. And so if you hold people to that, perhaps a negative generalization, it becomes a self-fulfilling. You don't give them a chance. And that's what was beautiful about a full-spectrum political audience. I still could make that appeal to those people. And they may or may not, they may disagree with my perception of the threat, but I ask them to take responsibility for their choice. And I give, by my participation, I make that a choice. You notice the Democrat, Kristen Wirth, she's a fine lady, but she did not address climate at all. And that's exactly why it's important for me to be in this race. I thought that might happen, and now I know that it is.
Well, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. I appreciate your being here at Buena Vista today, and I hope you enjoy your Labor Day.
Okay, so I can check that out.
And we'll be, this will be online on Saturday morning.
Okay.
And it's on the air, and you probably won't hear it, but WINC in Winchester on Saturday morning at 7 a.m.
Will they have a webcast?
Yes, the podcast will be on BearingDrift.com Saturday morning,
okay.
Around 7 o'clock.
Okay. Yeah, well, thanks for the opportunity to get this message out. Our opportunity to address this comes when there's this aha moment that we have to limit our emissions to the amount that can be removed. You know, that's our aha moment where we have a chance.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere.
Be sure to come back next week for more news, reviews, and interviews. Tell your friends how to find the score and take part in the conversation in the comments section on BearingDrift.com. We'll be looking for you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at RickSincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bearing Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BearingDrift.com.